Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined by an old friend, Canon Flowers. How are you, sir?
I'm fantastic, Mike. Thanks for asking.
I haven't been on the show for a little while. You've been traveling the world and doing things. I've mainly been working on some very interesting security stuff I've been noticing.
Trying to, yeah. Working with vendors and custom hardware and firmwares and all that good stuff.
For people that I know you as an editor and as somebody, obviously from this show and stuff, they may not know you have a very strong history in programming and, dare I say, lowercase hacking, lowercase h hacking, proper sort of black hat type stuff.
Well, you know, I consider myself an artisan of technology, if there is such a thing, and I like the word hacking when it's used in that way, so I'll take that as a compliment. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, it's very much the mentor's one. And we're also joined on the line by Ian Fales. Ian, how are you, my friend?
Good, Mike. How are you going?
Good, good. We sit here this morning recording this, not having any particular government in my local, Ian's and I, home country of Australia. We've just had an election here that no one can decide who should run the country. So in that state of limbo, we're going to discuss a blockbuster American film. And the film is Night and Day, a Tom Cruise vehicle for returning him to credible megastardom power. And we're going to discuss the film, we're going to discuss its visual effects, and we're going to discuss some of the aspects about the role of visual effects in terms of how it's marketed with a film now and even perceived with a film these days, because this is a film that has some... now, Ian, did you, or was it... Kenna, did you work out how many visual effects were actually in the film in total?
Yeah, there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 700 VFX shots in the film. I heard 720.
Right, so that's a reasonable number. It's not a film like a 2012 where the effects are full front of house. It's certainly not a period sci-fi or otherwise massively characteristically visual effects heavy, rich kind of film. It doesn't have a digital character, but 720 shots gets your attention. So it's certainly got the attention of this show. So we're going to discuss that later in the show. Before that, I just wanted to start out by having a discussion about the film. And I don't think we can discuss the film without leading with the issue of this as a sort of a star vehicle for Tom Cruise. Ian, what did you think of the film? What did you think of Tom Cruise? If you weren't involved with the show, would you have gone and seen it?
Well, I quite liked the film. I had a lot of fun with it. And I think that fun came from not really knowing what was going to happen. You weren't really sure, you know, what Tom Cruise's character was all about until about halfway in the film. I really, really didn't like the ending, and I don't want to spoil it.
We don't record these on the day the film comes out precisely because we will discuss the ending. So that's fine. I mean, anyone that's listening knows that that's why these shows don't come out the week the film comes out. We're not trying to be a spoiler, but go on, talk about the end.
Well, what I didn't like about the ending was this battery that Tom Cruise is trying to protect and make sure it doesn't get into the hands of the bad guys starts warming up and starts heating up. And as soon as that happens, you just know it's going to blow up or something's going to happen. And I think basically as soon as you find that out, the story just goes downhill. So I was a bit disappointed with that angle of the film. But, you know, generally I had fun and I thought Tom Cruise did okay. He seemed to play a different character in this. He was sort of going more for comedy. And obviously that's the banter between him and Cameron Diaz. But, yeah, I'd give this film one thumb up.
So, Karen, from my point of view, the battery thing was almost incidental. You needed a device for some reason for the chase, but at no point did we really care about the battery or did we think the battery is anything other than this week's current obvious kind of tech device thing. Was that the case for you?
Yeah, I think the battery is clearly the MacGuffin in the film, and you sort of need one in this kind of film. Otherwise, it comes apart at the seams, and so I was okay with the battery itself. I had no issues with that at all.
Yeah, the film wasn't about the battery, it just was this device that they needed to do stuff.
Right, exactly. And I'm going to actually go out and say I sort of liked the film as well. I didn't love it, but I sort of liked it. And
I'd have taken bets on the fact you would have not liked this film.
Yeah, you know what did it for me? I was prepared to hate it and despise it in a kind of way that only David Strapinas can. And what happened was there's a scene where Tom Cruise kidnaps Cameron Diaz. You know, he pulls her out of the little coffee shop restaurant. And he says, "If you follow me, I'll kill myself and then her." And that scene made the movie for me. That scene let me know, you know what? It's okay for this film to be wildly out of reality. It's okay for it to be a fairy tale. It's kind of a, you know, if you took Collateral and put it in a blender with a little acid, you'd get this film, and that's all right. You know, I actually enjoyed it.
I guess for me, there's a couple of things about this film. The normal situation with Tom Cruise just as an actor, from what we know, because this is quite a complicated area, much more complicated than I think most people believe, is that Tom Cruise gets not only a large paycheck, but let me just back up for a second. Most people get quoted large paychecks. So in other words, if I was a mega movie star in my head, but maybe not in your head, I might put out a press release saying that I'm getting $10 million a movie, $5 million a movie. In reality, I don't get $5 million check at the outset of the production. What I get is like maybe $500,000 and a promise for $4.5 million if the film goes well. And quite frankly, the film never goes well to the point of making a profit, as we kind of know from the lawsuits around Hollywood. But if it goes well, I might get another million check and or two. But the point is, I can put out the press release saying I'm a $5 million star. Cruise changed that by actually having first gross dollar. So he would basically get literally the same promise with a fairly substantial upfront, more substantial actually than most people would get. But then after that period where he's, you know, got the check and then we're waiting for returns, most people have to wait for net returns, and he doesn't get that. He gets first dollar gross, which means he's basically first in line to get money. Now, his published PR salary for this went down for this film, but also his ability to get first dollar went down. And so there's nothing more indicative of a star's perhaps less than stellar pull at the box office than those two things happening: salary going down and they're no longer first in line to get money. So that, combined with the fact that we know the script was rewritten about seven times specifically to make it a good vehicle for Tom Cruise, adding the comedy in that you like, I sort of approached the film from the point of view of, well, is this going to return Tom Cruise to that kind of MI franchise making, you'll go and see any film that he's in kind of star level? And what I came out from the film realizing is that I think he shouldn't have gone for that. I think he should have gone for a Bruce Willis approach of, let's go and do some other films that are interesting that I act in and not try and sustain. Because he's got to be, what, 50 now? How old? Anyone know how old Tom Cruise is?
No.
Now, I'm not saying he's past it, because if anything, this last weekend, The Expendables showed that a bunch of stars, and Stallone is like 64, can still open at the box office. But in that case, it was much of a nod and a wink to the baby boom, as if to say, hey, come back and look at these old stars, and you remember Dolph Lundgren, and you remember kind of thing. And people went on. It was, you know, Stallone was practically winking at the audience the whole way through, saying, yeah, don't you want to see me blow something up, right? Okay, I'll go blow something up. And I think Tom Cruise kind of went back into this film to be a more legitimate action star. And so I just feel like he shouldn't have done that. I think that I understand he wants to regain his credibility. I feel like, you know, he jumped the sofa and as a consequence, he's trying to get back. But I just feel like some serious acting is probably a better path, because I just think this film, while fun and entertaining, you know, just reminded me of how much I used to like the old Tom Cruise back in the... Do you remember, was it The Client, the law drama he was in? Was The Client, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
That or was a good firm. Film. Yeah, The Firm, or whatever. It was either The Client or The Firm, yeah. But it was just the, you know, great kind of legal thing, and it was a good drama, and it was a good bunch of twists. It was, you know, he did lots of running like he always does in every film. And it was just, you know, a good... And I liked MI3 a lot. I'm you know, MI1, but 2 and 3, I really enjoyed them as films. So I just felt like, well, because, you know, the mandatory shots of him with his shirt off and stuff, I was like, really, really? But it's kind of, it gets to a point where you, is that what you want to be sort of selling yourself on? Not that he looks bad. I mean, it's great, obviously. But I don't know. I just feel like, so I sort of, and the reason I'm caging this discussion in that, and you might be wondering why I'm talking about Tom Cruise so much, is because everything in the film, therefore, was stacked to achieve the end of returning Tom to kind of box office action star, but in a kind of a cheeky, boyish... I mean, I was almost picking, you know, there's the Tom Cruise shot from this film, there's the Tom Cruise from that shot. Remember, there's a shot where he actually overlooks the top of his sunglasses. It's Risky Business. It's like almost frame for frame, it felt like in my head, from Risky Business. It's like he ticked off every bloody film he'd done that was successful. you know, it was like, oh, that's the Top Gun moment, that's the whatever moment. And so the visual effects obviously had to follow in the same line. The visual effects were there to support Tom as action guy. And to a certain extent, I don't think they failed in doing that. I just kind of thought at the end of the film, yeah, really, couldn't we have made a different film that would have been a better vehicle for restoring Tom to kind of super credibility than this film, which really, to me, I don't think was super successful. I know at the box office hasn't been super successful. It's like $120 million. And as you say, there's like a lot of visual effects in it, 720 shots to support Tom looking like a good action hero. But anyway, that's my take on the film. So, Ian, do you disagree with me, or what do you think?
I don't disagree with you. I wonder whether when you say those shots of Tom Cruise that look like they're from other movies, that that's all done on purpose. And it's a because it's a comedy, you know, it's a little bit of an homage to those films, because people are going to see this film probably for Tom Cruise, and, you know, they kind of get what they're given in some ways.
I mean, my wife liked the film. She thought it was great. She's not very critical of sort of fun films. She likes going and sort of enjoying them, and she was like, yep, great. But I think we had fairly low expectations. I don't know we were seeing it because it was a Tom Cruise film. I think we were seeing it because it was a lightweight kind of action. It's a bit like a romantic comedy action film kind of thing. But I don't know. Kenan, what did you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. I was actually going to point out I had a whole list of shots where – it looked like something we had already seen before. You know, there's that really great wink to Mission Impossible where he's on the car and the little piece flies over him and he does this sort of Matrix fallback effect. There's so many of those that it did get a little tiresome, I think. This is somebody who liked the film. I have the opposite, which is my wife, who's usually not very critical of films, bagged on this film with the kind of intensity that I've never seen her attack a film with. She hated it. She was like, you know, she just despised it. And we'll get to the thing she despised most, which was the running of the bulls scene.
Okay.
Just hated it.
We'll definitely be discussing that in visual effects in 1 second. The director of this was James Mangold. I think I pronounced his name right. And so he did Walk the Line, which I thought was a terrific film. And, you know, some of those biopics can be kind of not so good. So clearly the director well in control of his craft, and he'd done other films that I respected. So I don't really level much in the way of criticism. I think it's just a film designed for a purpose, and I think it's going to be judged as such. I expected to be judging it for that. I sort of was a bit annoyed at the end. Not annoyed, but just disappointed that it wasn't created for a different purpose.
Right. You've looked at the past of this film, though, right?
Yeah.
From when it was called Wichita and Adam Sandler was attached, and then they changed the name, I think, to Trouble Man, and Chris Tucker and Eva Mendes were attached, and then Gerard Butler at one point, and then Cameron Diaz came in, and then there have been so many people involved in this. And I know that one of the things Cruz said is he wanted to bring his own special whatever, joie de vivre, whatever, to the film. And I wonder how many of these little winks and nods and things that are happening were Cruz himself kind of pushing that on the audience.
Yeah, I just feel like the audience can be taken – well, it's not that they're talking down to the audience. It's just that they're assuming what the audience wants, and the audience wants is what it's had before. And I would just think what the audience really wants is something that it hasn't had before that's a bit different. And but this is, you know, the common problem in Hollywood right now. I mean, Inception has shown that original scripts have a place in some Hollywood blockbusters, but it was so exceptional in that it was an original script that it's like the only one of its kind virtually. Almost everything else is derived from a very well-known comic book, previous source or remake of a TV show. But look, this isn't the movie show, this is the VFX show, so let's swing to the visual effects. And I guess, Ian, the first thing is there's actually a host of companies that came up on the roster for this film. This was not a one-facility feature.
That's right. The overall soup was Eric Durst, and there's kind of some main sequences, I suppose, we'll end up talking about. The running of the bulls and the shots in Spain were done by Rhythm and Hughes, and Weta did some really great shots on the train in the Austrian Alps. There's a bunch of other companies. In terms of the visual effects, I really did think that they were there, and it's the old mantra, to serve the story, They never really popped out at me. Even the running of the bulls sequence went by so quickly that I just didn't think, you know, they lingered on it too long, which was kind of good. And some other shots I thought they did quite quickly where they could have gone a bit longer, but I'm glad they didn't, was, you know, that first plane crash that was sort of went by quickly, and there's a little explosion and then suddenly it cuts to another shot, and even the last plane explosion was sort of off in the distance and, you know, not sort of main screen. So, in that way, I like the way that they approach the visual effects.
So was there any sequence for you that you thought was particularly good just from a purely visual effects point of view?
Oh, I actually really like the running of the bull stuff because I know a little bit about it. They did have some practical bulls in there and sort of augmented it with their own digital ones. And as I say, that they didn't really linger on those scenes. Even the shot of the bulls sort of crashing into that smart car went by so quickly, and I thought it was actually pretty dynamic. So, yeah, probably that shot was my favourite in the film.
And, Cannon, what about you?
Oh, I thought the Weta train sequence was flawless. I think if I were to, you know, point out anything in the film that just did not look like CG and was executed extremely well, I would say it was all that train work. It was amazing. I don't even partially agree with the running of the bulls comments that Ian made.
Well, before we get onto that, because I just want to pick up on that, because I actually think you're right. I think Weta is just so strong at the moment. So astonishingly strong that I would, with a critical eye, have never picked that there were 139 shots on the train. And yeah, as many you regular listeners will know, my big kind of barometer of a film's good or not is with the car shots normally out the window. And normally, if you've got a mid to not very good compositor, they won't composite out the window successfully. It'll look overexposed, too sharp, won't move right. It just will not feel real. And yet, the train sequence, it was so well done. And it's not particularly hard. Weta themselves are not, you know, particularly trumpeting it because it isn't like a digital character like Gollum. It's not an amazing sort of feat of digital environments in quite the same way that Avatar is or something. And yet you just get this ordinary sequence and Weta puts what? I think Ian was there about 40 artists on it or something?
Yeah, that's right. For 5 weeks, yeah.
And they just nail it. And Cannon, I think you're absolutely right. Like, there's just, like, I think we need to kind of put the spotlight on just that kind of perfect work. That if you were to sign Weta up for a sequence in a film today, you'd be like, okay, tick that box. That's going to work. Because I can't fault the guys. They're just knocking it out of the park at the moment. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree completely. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we tend to overlook when we're looking at films like this, and to make your point even a little stronger, you know, it's one thing to do Gollum, and I take nothing away from that, and that is fantastic work, and, you know, it's a standing ovation. But you're doing something that people haven't seen a million times with their own eyes, and so you have the kind of latitude that Weta just didn't have on these train sequences. And like you say, everything you could imagine, if the color is off, if the white balance is off, if there's anything going wrong, if there's, you know, an edge that you detect movement on, that throws you out of the film, or at least it throws me out of the film. And I can't, you know, I'm going to use the word flawless again. Their execution was flawless. I think it's the kind of special effects that we need to pay more attention to and appreciate more, because I think it's the harder kind.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of stuff about that. I completely agree with you, because I'll add to your list of you need the keys to be incredibly fine. You need to be managing kind of smudges on the glass. And none of these things are super hard, but it's one of those things like having a really good meal at a restaurant where the meal is something that, you know, you know. It's not like you're getting an unusual dish and you've got no idea what the heck it is. And you just know that if any part of the meal is off, the audience or the client sitting there or the customer will pick it. And this is exactly the case with this. It's not that this is the hardest stuff in the world. It's just that I can't imagine this was a film that got A-grade attention at Weta. I mean, you know, in the middle of some other huge projects, I'm sure, you know, you could easily argue, well, that we had the B-team on it. But you just don't get that out of Weta. You don't get the B-team on if they're only doing a small number of shots on a film. You just get really good stuff. And there are so many aspects that seem to go wrong so often in so many other minor kind of out-the-window type work. And, you know, yeah, there's Rodo, there's Keying, there's CG, the trees. Well, maybe Ian, you could tell us how they actually did that sort of CG environment out the trees. It's quite an inventive but simple approach.
That's right. They didn't actually go for a full CG environment out the window, and I suppose that's one of the beauties of the shots, probably also because they only had a small time to do it, although I'm sure they could have done it. What they ended up doing was having more of a tree sprite application in Nuke, where they sort of used some old turntables of some CG pine trees and sort of were able to space them out at various distances and make them go past the camera at those different distances and speeds. And it gave you that great sort of motion blur look, you know, of the scene going by. So, yeah, it was quite a simple approach, but it just worked so well. And I think even the visual effects supervisor was astounded by it because, you know, it was shot in Spain in a big sort of warehouse with train cars and green screen.
And those sprite cards, those effectively cards with projected images sitting on the cards, would look exactly like cards if you ever saw them from the side, but they orientate themselves 90 degrees to the camera constantly, so you always have the cards effectively face on. So because that is the case, you never get to see a tree looking suddenly like a piece of paper, and you never see its edge, and it never gives away the trick. And also, you can actually access into the turntable as you go past it. So imagine you had 100 frames going from looking at a tree as if it was coming towards you to looking at a tree as it's going away from you. And that tree doesn't move in a sense that it doesn't animate, but all that happens is you've got, say, 100 frames, which is not quite 180 degrees, but let's imagine it's, you know, close to 180 degrees worth of view on the tree. Well, obviously, if the card faces the train, you simply show the picture of the tree from the side. And as the card gets so that it's beside the train, you access into that 100 frames to pick the middle frame. And as the card moves away from you, turn it back again. So it still faces the camera, so you don't see that paper-like edge on it, but you just access a different frame that's projected onto the card. A simple concept. And I guess I bring it up because I know a lot of people listen to the VFX show just love movies, but a bunch of people listen to the VFX shows working artisans and working artists, and it's just great, I think, to get some of these more simple techniques, because that's a technique I would use myself in a flame comp with some expressions if I was doing this again myself or something like this. And I love that that's that simple. Now, I think you have to be into the industry to get this excited about what is, after all, fairly mundane window replacement shots, but I do think anything done this well deserves attention. So, you know, yeah, hats off. And I just can't think of the last time I had any reason to criticize work out of Weta. I think they have such depth. It's awesome. So I'm so glad, Kanan, that you identified that. But you also flagged the running of the bull. So do you want to give us your take on that?
Well, yeah, my take, I'll summarize it pretty briefly, which is, I did not think it was very good. I think that there was an awful lot of work being put into it, but I think at the end of the day, something happened with the shading and the lighting, and I could pick out maybe not in a still frame, because I've seen the still frames online and they don't actually look the same way, but in the moving image, I could pick out every single bull that wasn't real. It stood out to me like a spotlight. And I'm not 100% sure if that's, once again, you know, we talk about, in the past we've talked about projection systems and lighting and all these different things, and I'm not 100% sure if it was just where I saw it or how I saw it, but I could really tell the difference between the live and the artificial bulls.
Now, was your wife's problem with this that she thought it looked fake, or that they were in the wrong city for the running of the bulls?
Well, ironically, having just traveled to Europe, she did point that out. Like, what the F is going, you know? But no, she thought it looked fake as well. And she's not really a trained eye. So, you know, when she thinks something looks fake, I mean, this is a woman where, you know, when I met her 5 years ago, she was not aware that they actually cut film to show.
I should just point out that your wife is a very intelligent woman, that this is just not her
expertise. She's extremely intelligent.
She just didn't know. Yeah, I just want to make this absolutely clear that she's a very nice person. She just
She's fantastic.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, I married her. I think she's fantastic.
Yeah.
But she wasn't aware. It just didn't occur to her, right? She was an average moviegoer who didn't think about the nuances of the films and television. It just didn't occur to her that, like in a TV show like Grey's Anatomy, that they had multiple cameras going and they were cutting between shots. It just didn't occur to her. And here, you know, 5 years later, she's saying those bulls look fake. So I'm just trying to put that in perspective a little bit.
So, Ian, did you think the bulls worked?
I did. And, you know, it's funny because I'd obviously talked to Rhythm and written an article about the film and then saw the film. And you know, I guess I could see which ones were created digitally. But the sequence goes by so quickly, as I said, and I just thought it was quite dynamic and, you know, kind of fun with the motorbike and everything that perhaps, you know, I still think it worked. And actually, you know, thinking a bit more, I actually don't think they look that fake. You know, if you look at the shots that Rhythm did, there's sort of real bulls right next to CG ones, and I'm not sure that I could tell.
Well, Rhythm is the go-to place for digital animals. There's just no – since the days of Babe and they won the Oscar, they've had incredibly good in-house tools for hair combing and grooming for fur. And on this one, in fact, they had a muscle system that actually allowed for sort of looser skin over the surface of the muscles, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
right. And I saw all of that, and in fact, if you recall, in the past, I have complimented them quite well on the work that they've done. I just, for some reason, I'll give you a specific example. There's a scene where there's a real car. It's the smart car, and it gets turned over, and there are obviously that. So that's practical effects, and then there are CG bulls jumping over it. Now, the still shots of that look fantastic. The moving frames, the bulls just, they don't look real. They have maybe that new technique that they're using gives everything kind of a rubbery feel that doesn't seem very natural to me, but to my eye, that just was not well executed.
So I thought your problem when you first started talking was maybe an integration with the live action, but it actually doesn't sound like it's a black level kind of projection type problem. If you think that the motion is wrong, that's inherently in the frame no matter how you're looking at it. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think that's what it is. And like I say, I think it just looks a little too rubbery for my taste, which is why in a still frame it looks fantastic and in a moving frame it doesn't. But, you know, again, this is my perspective.
Well, that's why we have you on, right? As to how well it works. I guess I liked it. I think Rhythm does a really, really good job. I think that you're going to make life hard for yourself if you're going to put digital bulls right next to live ones, because in some of those shots, you know, there is nowhere to hide. It's one thing to say that doesn't look how I remember a bull looking. It's another thing to say it doesn't look like the bull that's 3 pixels to its left. I guess one thing that can help if you get the motion blur right, and I genuinely think that the motion blur algorithms and the rendering pipeline that Rhythm has does tend to produce good motion blur, does tend to produce spec highlights that work correctly in terms of the way spec highlights remain bright when blurred through motion blur and all that kind of stuff. I didn't really have a problem with the bulls. I didn't engage a lot in this sequence for my same old problem that I always have, which is when someone's proven to an audience that they cannot die because they've already done 10 impossible things before breakfast, then I just don't get that on the edge of my seat that anything's going to happen. I never expected for a second that these guys would be in any way hurt, fall, crushed, killed, or whatever. It was just going to be a set piece, and at the other end, we'd come out and get on with the story a little. And I was a little interested to ponder this. I'd seen a press thing beforehand where they were saying that Cruise did a lot of his own stunts, which I'd always found to be, quite frankly, unbelievably absurd, because I can't imagine anyone giving a completion bond to a film. Since the days of that James Bond film that had Roger Moore and he did a stunt and did his shoulder in and they had to shut down production for months and cost them millions, no actor gets to do their own stunts. I understand, though, that he did, in fact, ride his motorbike through. Do you know, Ian, how much actual stuff he did? Because generally speaking, insurance companies, not the director, not the actor, but the insurance companies will absolutely forbid the stars from doing stuff just because it doesn't make any economic sense for the risk of the production.
Yeah, I think he did some things. There are shots, say, where they're on the motorbike and they're going out the exit of that bull ring, and, you know, that's definitely stunt riders, and you know, Rhythm did a bunch of face replacements for Cameron Diaz and Tom Cruise. So obviously they were using the stunt riders a fair bit, I think. But you do read about Tom Cruise doing a lot of wire work, you know, on the top of the buildings when he's running away in that other scene. A bunch of that was him, and you know, so it's always a bit of a mix, probably.
I guess I don't take anything away from. I'm not saying that Cruise is a coward or anything. Absolutely not. Far from it. I'm sure he'd be happy to do stuff, but I just don't think that you would sensibly do stuff. And this idea of them doing wire work always invokes, I think, in the audience's mind that you're flying from building to building with just a wire and to save you in case something goes wrong. Whereas in reality, if you go up a scissor lift, they make you put a wire on you and a hard hat normally, and they let you take the hard hat off for the shot kind of thing. So the idea that they've got wires on them versus wire work are two vastly different things. You have an actor running along something which has a 4-foot drop, and they'll probably put a safety thing in there and a couple of guys with cushions. So and again, not because the actors are pussy, it's just because they just don't want to shut down production because he sprains his ankle and it'd be incredibly expensive. This sequence that we're discussing, was it shot even in sort of, it must have been shot in Spain at least, right?
Well, that turns out that they shot it both in Spain and obviously, not obviously, but at the Universal lot. So I wonder whether some of Kanan's problems with the shots are that you can tell sometimes that, you know, it's shot in Los Angeles and some on location. But they ran out of time during filming to finish a lot of the shooting in Spain. So I think quite a lot of it was done on the Universal lot.
That car flipping shot, I think that might have been done. I have to confess, I actually went on the Universal backlot tour when I was in LA for Sid Graff. Now, before you shoot me down as being that is the geekiest, stupidest, most ridiculous thing. Okay, and I had a reason to do it. Ian made me.
Did I? How's that?
Well, he organized for us to do a story with Weta on the Kong 360 ride, and the only way we could see the 360 ride was to go on the Universal backlot tour, which of course then goes into the new Weta Kong 360 degree 60 frame a second part of the tour, so I blame you, Ian. But anyway, we went on, and I've got to say, the fact that they shot on the Universal backlot per se doesn't bother me because, quite frankly, they're good sets. I mean, they're like, you know, they look good. I mean, you know, I don't.
Yeah,
think
and for people who've never seen it or never taken the cheesy geeky tour like you have, you should also explain it's. To call it a backlot is kind of a I don't think you really understand the vastness and the amount of complexity of the sets and the kind of things that they can do when you use a phrase like backlot, right? I mean, this is an enormous area with a lot of moving parts, with a lot of open and closed buildings. I mean, you could pretty much build a city inside of this place.
Yeah, well, there are cities built in, so sort of.
And that, this is my point, yes.
Yeah, and a lot of CSI and that kind of stuff gets done there these days because, quite frankly, you know, it's easier to go to New York on the Universal backlot than it is to fly over to New York. And there is a huge amount of issues with filming on a street, with releasing bulls and doing stuff. I mean, and even flipping a car, quite frankly, because if you're flipping a car and you're in a neighborhood and, you know, you've got a leaflet drop everyone in the street and you've got to make sure that the street can be shut down with alternate routes for traffic, and then there are noise issues, and there's you've got, you know, you do all that hoping that the weather holds, for example, and you've got very little flexibility. So I don't have any problem with them actually shooting on the Universal backlot, because people, which I think leads into our last part of the discussion, people talk about, oh, it was shot on the backlot rather than doing it for real, and I'm like, well, really, you really think that Tom Cruise is a secret agent? I mean, when this idea for real really bothers me. I think I mentioned this before. You know, they're not real guns. They're not real spies. Those aren't real anything, yet alone real events. And, of course, this is mainly leveled at CG. So we'll do it for real instead of doing it in camera. And I think this has actually got almost out of control now, with CG kind of getting a bad name. And I'm really, obviously, fairly defensive about this. Would you agree, Kanan?
I would absolutely agree. I mean, the reality of the situation is, you, having shot a film myself and worked on a fair few of them, you do whatever it takes to get the effing shot. I mean, if that's shooting it on the back lot, if that's hanging upside down from a tree, you know, if that's whatever that is, if it's CG, if it's what you get the damn shot. And that's the key. And I think what people don't realize, and I'm sad that more people don't realize this, making a film is difficult. Making a good film is nearly impossible. And making a film where people look at it and actually believe what they're watching without being taken out of the film is, you know, that's godlike. And, you know, so you put a turntable with some trees on it. You know, do light pings like J.J. Abrams has gotten, has started doing and become fond of. You just do whatever it takes to make it look good. And that could be anything. And I don't care if it's shot on the back lot or underwater or upside down or on a skateboard or if it's just all CG. If it looks great and it works and it moves the story along, I'm in.
Yeah, and I think my problem is that bad acting gets blamed on the actor, but bad CG, you feel like you should blame it just on the CG company, though quite often it's directed thus, because if you have a director that says, I want the explosion 10 times bigger, and you go, well, that would be kind of... I'm reminded by... Stu Mashowitz told me this story once. He was standing in the tape room back in the day that he worked in a tape room, and Stu obviously gone on to do, you know, major stuff as a visual effects supervisor. He'd worked at ILM. So Stu's like, for those of you who don't know, really well-known figure in our industry and highly respected. And he was standing in his early days watching a tape dub going on of Die Hard. And at the point at which they were doing some kind of reel for the Oscars or some dumb thing, you remember Bruce Willis's chair on some kind of rocket thing explodes. He goes up in the air. I think he jettisons out of a plane that's exploding, but it's still on the tarmac. And he goes right up at camera, and there's a big explosion underneath him, and then he falls away. It's like a trailer shot. Do you guys know the shot I'm referring to?
Yeah, in Die Hard 2,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Okay, so he's watching this monitor, and someone over his shoulder says, what do you think of that shot? And, you know, you're in an enclosed environment of a facility, so you know, sort of thing happens all the time. And so he says, well, you know, it'd be really hard to do that shot because it's almost impossible to have something that sort of choreographically unbelievable look real. And the guy behind him went, yeah, good answer. And it turned out to be the director of the film. He just didn't know that until he turned around. But I think that was just the perfect answer, which is if the director says that they want the explosion to cause Bruce Willis to come right up at camera, pause for a beat, twist, and then fall away, and the audience is going to be either 16-year-old kids like me who were like, yeah, cool shot, yeah, awesome, or somebody that's going to go, yeah, it's so unbelievable, it's so kind of contrived, it just doesn't feel real. And I think that's the problem that we get into, is that if you get a contrived CG effect, then that's coming from the director and from even the studio. CG artist is going to respond in doing it. The trouble is it's unfair to label that as just bad CG. And my point would be to prove that if CG was bad and lots of CG was worse, then wouldn't all CG be appalling? And of course it isn't, because all CG is Pixar and delightful films like Legend of Gahul and a whole bunch of other stuff that we just know is gorgeous, magnificent, and really interesting, and stuff that is done that's fully CG is incredibly, incredibly engaging because it's got a good story. And so I'm just angry at the fact that that CG gets labelled. And I think, Ian, you found a reference specifically to this film criticising the CG, didn't you?
That's right. There's a review online by Roger Ebert, who's a very well-respected film reviewer, but he basically launches into an attack of the CGI, saying that there was too much and it was very distracting and, didn't work, I suppose. Which is interesting because I really came out of the film thinking that there wasn't really much in there at all. And, of course, we've talked about the 720 shots. But he really has a different perspective, saying that it's very distracting, you know, which I totally disagree with. But I just wonder whether that's because he wasn't a big fan of the story and he decided to attack something.
But surely, wouldn't you say, Kanan, that that's a directed remark at the set pieces, the action sequences, and you just put this label of CG on them because you'd expect CG to be involved in any of the plane crashes, the running of the bulls, the flipping cars, it didn't seem CG to me. Did it seem CG to you?
No, while I was watching the show, I was surprised that this was a show that was on the VFX show while I was watching it, because I thought there's just not a lot of CG in this film. And then when I came out of it, obviously, and you know, I took a look. I mean, there are a whole lot of studios involved in this, some of which I want to talk briefly about later. But I maybe, you know, like you said, maybe he's just, maybe he doesn't understand what CGI means. Maybe he's blaming set pieces. Maybe, who knows what it is. But I mean, I think except for the running of the bulls scene and a certain amount of the sort of attack on Jamaica part of the movie, I wasn't just staring at the screen and going, wow, there's a lot of CG in this thing.
I mean, the plane crash, we haven't discussed that. Hydraulics did it. It was, you know, not the center point of the film, but it was a nice sort of sequence plowing through a field. And I thought that it was appropriate use of CG. You could have crashed a plane as a miniature. You could have crashed a CG. You couldn't cheat the audience out of seeing the plane crash. So how are you going to do it? Well, you did it sensibly with CG that looked good, and then you didn't overplay it, and you didn't, you know, milk it for all it was worth. I think a point you made, Ian, it just worked.
Yeah, and, you know, I wonder whether it's a shot design issue or a budget issue, but I think I said before, they didn't linger on it. Maybe that's sometimes a measure of bad CG when they sort of stay on the shot too long and you sort of get a lot of time to look at it and analyze the, you know, the texturing or whatever it is. So in that way, a lot of the shots are like that. Even the Jamaica attack, which probably is a little bit weak in terms of those explosions. I think, you know, it's just so quick that they sort of move on to the next thing. And that's kind of how the film works anyway. It's a bit of a travelogue where she keeps getting drugged and sort of moving on to the next location.
Yeah, look, I think that it's a mistake to hang an entire film off just the VFX because I think it's, we all agreed it's the plot. But by the same token, a lot of films, like, let's think about it, 10 out of 10 of the top films of all time have really strong VFX in them. Audiences like good VFX. This whole idea that CG ruined it and or there's too much CG, it's just bollocks. I mean, it's just good effects the audience love. They consistently say so at the box office. And it allows you to take the audiences to places they otherwise couldn't go to in ways that they otherwise couldn't do, and introduce us to characters that we otherwise would never have on screen. And let's not forget that if you go back before we had strong CG, very few films would be able to clock up 700 shots. And they'd have to be, you know, well, if you go back before CG, quite frankly, no films would clock up 700. I mean, Terminator, which was nexus point between analog and digital, was still not, you know, that many CG shots. And people might say, well, that's you know, that's really great. We should go back to that. But your audiences today want to see more. They don't want to be cheated out of all the shots. And I don't hold at all with this theory that if you do it for real, it's better. I think if you do it in combination, in concert, it's perfect. I mean, Inception was visual effects and physical effects in, you know, harmony. I mean, you just do it if you can here, and you do it over here if you can't, and you don't get your knickers in a knot either way. You're not trying to not do CG, and you're also trying to not do everything in CG, and it's just a well-made film. And I just would wish we could get to a point past this kind of fear of CG, because CG is a, as a dirty word, is completely uncalled for.
Hear, hear.
I agree with you, Mike.
I guess I'm preaching to the choir, huh? You guys are like, yeah, whatever, Mike. Yeah, get on with it. Anyway, I just am insulted by the backlashy thing. I just think it's outrageous.
Yeah, I don't understand it. It reminds me, I recently read an interview with Ray Bradbury, and they were talking about Ray Bradbury's books and whether or not he was going to put them online. And Bradbury said, there are far too many machines and far too many internets, and we can't live with all these machines surrounding us, and it's, you know, it's going to be a problem. And hey, he just went on and on and on about how awful it was that we had all this technology and all these machines and all these internets around us. And, you know, I was reading this on my Kindle, and I was thinking, wow, I appreciate that you are a good writer, but you're kind of talking about something you're not familiar with here.
I wonder if he writes with pen and paper.
I mean, I'm sure he does. You know? I mean, he has this big problem with his stuff being on the Kindle and everything else. But I mean, that's, you know, that's the way of it. And I think I would much rather. I mean, this is just, you know, I'm a Life Zero kind of guy, so I would much rather read on the Kindle. I would much rather have someone blow up a plane using computers than blow up an actual plane. I mean, if you can make one look as good as the other.
Yeah, I mean,
it costs less. Why blow up a damn plane?
I watched The Expendables, and I kept on, actually leaned over to my wife at one point and said, I really hope they bought carbon offsets for all of these fireballs. let's take it as read then that we're mortally offended by people that don't understand CG and blame it for things that are not its fault. And let's swing back to the film. So we discussed briefly hydraulics. I think they did a good job on the early plane crash in the cornfield. And I think they also did some stuff in Austria, did they?
They did some hotel stuff in Salzburg, which if you've been to Salzburg, they did such a fantastic job. And I think the guy who did that work was, I don't know how to pronounce his name, it was like Eric Lyles, L-I-L-E-S. He was the supervisor for hydraulics. Eric.
That's right. Yep.
You are awesome. I have to say, I literally was just in Salzburg not a month before seeing this film, and amazing references, beautiful scene. I mean, what a great job on the hotels. Hydraulics really nailed that. I thought the plane crash sequence in the cornfield was good too. The problem I had with it wasn't the exterior. It was the stupid ass interior where you're constantly looking out at, you know, corn smashing into the window or at whatever that choice was, but the effects were great.
So I agree. I think hydraulics did a really good job. Hydraulics is moving steadily, it seems, from just doing 911 kind of emergency work to more kind of front of house sequences. There's a couple of companies like that I'm keeping an eye on. I guess another one that I haven't heard of, maybe you have, Ian, recently, is Asylum, who did such astonishingly good work on Master and Commander, but did that transition from... Do you know what Asylum's up to these days?
Well, they just finished work on Sorcerer's Apprentice, so they did some really good stuff on that.
Great CG in that film, but there's a film where the CG should not be blamed, but in fact the plot and the acting should.
Well, we'll hold that for another day. So, but there are companies like that that have, you know, come up the ranks as companies that were primarily targeting late delivery stuff, and you know, not like a Weta that was 5 years in the making of the film kind of thing. And then they've made the transition over, and they tend to produce really, really good artists because those artists have to work hard and fast and solve problems that other people failed on. They get sort of called in to solve somebody else's problem. And so hydraulics, do really good work. And the other thing, of course, is hydraulics' sister company is Lola, who now secretly for many years have been doing so much of the actor work. I don't know, and I certainly don't want to get sued, but I have no idea if Tom Cruise had any actor work done. But many actors do get work done on them digitally. In fact, it's in their contract. Other companies that worked on this, 8VFX, Spin. That's Spin up in Canada, right, Toronto? Or was it Spin down in Atlanta?
I think it was the Toronto office. You also had Soho, which did a bunch of the flipping cars on the highway chase, and they also did the drone attack in Jamaica. Wildfire did a bunch of the sort of in-car composites. There's a lot of companies on this.
I think, was it Halon that did the previews on the whole thing?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Not quite sure how much previews there was. Definitely the bulls and a couple of the other sequences, but... you know, as we say, that there's so many companies on this, and you sort of come away not realizing that there's that much CG work. And,
I was going to say, because we haven't even finished, right? Because there's Big American, With a Twist, Wildfire. There's a bunch of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Pixelmondo.
Filmworks. I mean, has anyone got a count on that? Let's do a count, actually. Halon, Big, Twist, Wildfire, Pixelmondo, Filmworks, Spin, 8, Weta. I've got at least 10.
Yeah, I counted 12 or 13 when I was looking it up, yeah.
Wow. Why do you need that many? That seems to me an odd decision. I mean, does anyone have any reason that this film was a rush job or anything? I mean, I just don't understand the logic in farming that widely, because the logistics of having to just coordinate that many companies.
I'm not sure.
I don't have any I mean, can anyone think of a good reason other than logistics of scheduling why you'd want to have 12 companies involved? Because even if you allow for the fact that there are some big sequences, and it's nice to give a sequence to a facility that's a specialist, like, for example, Rhythm and Hughes. The fact of the matter is those big sequences kill shot counts pretty quickly, right? I mean, we'd said that just the train alone was like 120. How many was Rhythm and Hughes count?
I don't know what the Bulls and the Spain sequences ended up as.
It'd be 100 or at least, right?
Yeah. I don't know. Is there a trend nowadays to really give it to individual shops so that they really only have that sequence themselves?
Well, there's been a trend, to giving it to one house. I mean, Inception was all out of DNEG, but also ILM and Weta have been increasingly taking entire films.
Well, yeah, that's two major studios. I think in the other realm, what you're seeing is you're seeing kind of a specialization where, like you talked about, you know, Lola does the reconstructive work to make an actor not have a mole, and then, you know, this other company is known for animals, and then I think you're seeing a lot of specializations, and so it's possible that given the running of the Bulls, the way it was directed, it's possible that Mangold just wasn't familiar with visual effects in the kind of way that a lot of people, like say Nolan, are, and just didn't really know who to go to initially for different things, and so instead made the choice, which is a perfectly valid choice, of picking the shop which is best known for doing a certain kind of effect. And
yeah.
You see that a lot in films. I mean, this isn't the only film where I've seen, you know, a dozen visual effects houses, each one with their own specialization.
I guess the other thing to note, though, is that if you look at those facilities in terms of revenue and size and numbers of artists, Weta and Rhythm, obviously are major houses, two of the major eight. But after that, you kind of have this big gap. There aren't that many mid houses anymore, and then you get to these smaller places. Not that Spin, for example, is, you know, tiny, but it has commercials business, and it just doesn't have, you know, the hundreds of people that you would get at a Weta or at a Rhythm. And I don't know about Big American and With a Twist, but I agree with the specialization to do with matte paintings and a few of those other things. But I gotta say, like, it just feels like if you go maybe to the farm out approach, you end up having to use a lot of companies, because a lot of those smaller companies can't take on more than a bunch of shots. They can't take on hundreds of shots because you don't have like a lot of companies in that mid range. And let's not forget, those big houses are getting really big now. I mean, I was at a talk at SIGGRAPH where Sony was talking about their facilities, and they have something like, I don't know, five, I'm gonna even say six different locations now around the world. And you know, a lot of companies now have places in India, but even ILM is currently tooling up in Singapore. So there's Lucasfilm was there before, but ILM is actually hiring extensively right now in Singapore. So there's a lot of companies spread, those big names. I'm pretty sure Weta has nowhere but New Zealand, but apart from that, all the other companies that I'm pretty much aware of have multiple locations now. So they're pretty darn big. I think we're getting like a, seven Snow Whites and a bunch of dwarfs. I just don't think there's anything in the middle.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I read an article about 3 months ago that said that ILM had 2,000 unpaid interns working for them. I just thought, that's a huge number.
I think that's, I don't think that's accurate. Do you mean that as a joke?
I don't know.
No, I'm pretty sure.
No, I think they were serious.
I would say that is either not true or meant as a an exaggeration for purpose of effect. I certainly don't want to imply that, because ILM is got a very good reputation for looking after its artists, as opposed to some of the other things that have happened lately with companies in Canada and stuff. I'd hate to this show to imply otherwise.
Well, yeah, and I wasn't implying that. I was just saying that they're so big that they have that many interns. Actually, if I were in college and I were looking to get into visual effects and ILM offered me an opportunity to be an unpaid intern for a summer, I would jump on that with the kind of tenacity that you only see in Bulldogs.
Yeah,
because being an intern at ILM is a really good career move.
I get your point, though. I just really, to really make this, because I have researched this a lot lately with recruiters. Like, for example, I know DD has quarterly intakes of interns, and these are paid positions. These are not unpaid positions. I think there is a perception that the interns are always unpaid, and they're not. Now, they may not be paid, you know, a ton because, as you say, it's a terrific opportunity to get into the industry. But those companies, like the ones we mentioned, do tend to look after the you know, and do the right thing from a labor relations as well as an ethical point of view. So I'd hate to – well, check that out, but I'm pretty sure that's actually not true. Sorry to jump on you on that. But
no, no, that's all right. I didn't obviously mean it in any way to disparage ILM. I think they're fine, and I was just – let's call it hearsay and move on.
Okay. So look, that's it. So in summing up the film, I think this is going to go well on DVD and go well on iTunes-y kind of downloads. I'm sure in that respect it's popular. It's increasingly hard to get a film that gets bums on seats in a cinema, and increasing that audience is a young male audience, and maybe that young male audience, you know, Knight and Cruz aren't the draw cards. Though, as I said, that's completely spoiled by the huge box office done by the Baby Boomer Expendables. So I think the visual effects were pretty good. I'm not as down on them as perhaps some of my co-hosts are, but I think, it's a good film for the right expectations and the right audience. It's certainly not going to probably feature heavily at the Oscars, but hey, you know, I don't know. I think that there's a place for popcorn good films that are fun, and certainly this one seems to be the case. That's, I guess, my summation. Ian, what about you?
Yeah, I agree with you about it. Watching it on DVD, it's kind of film you can have a bit of fun with. It's a pity it didn't do better, because I think there's some pretty good shots in there and some good acting, but I walked away having a bit of fun, which I think is what you should have when you go and see a movie.
and you, Kenan?
Yeah, like I say, I liked it. I didn't love it, but I liked it. I didn't like the bull scene, but I've kind of beat that to death. I think that if I were to make a suggestion to someone, I would just say go in with an open mind and try not to think of this as a straight action movie or a straight this or a straight that, and really, you know, pay attention to the fact that the movie's just trying to have some fun. And if you go along for the ride, I mean, there's some really clever things going on in the film with, you know, you talked about Cameron Diaz being knocked out and all these different great scenes flashing around. And it's good. Good stuff.
So, look, we want to thank our producers. Matt Graham, he's a Sydney-based producer. He does an enormous amount of the editing and putting together of the shows. He's been a tireless worker behind the scenes for some time. And Todd Shulton is our other producer. Now, Todd is not based in Sydney, but Todd has been with us now for a fair while, and we all hooked up recently at SIDGRAPH, and it was just great to get the team together. And also all the other co-hosts, these guys, Ian and Cannon, who are with us today, obviously all give their time for the show. We really appreciate you guys doing it. We appreciate you guys also for listening to it and making the show so popular. This show is kind of stunningly successful, and we continue to be pleasantly surprised at how well it's been finding an audience. So we want to thank you guys for listening. And Ian, if people want to check out more of what you're up to, where's a good place to do that?
Oh, you can just look me up on Twitter at twitter.com/VFXblog.
Excellent. And Cannon, what about you?
The best way to find me and hear or see or whatever the things that I'm doing is just to go over to lifezero.org.
And are you going to be doing more podcasts?
Yeah, you know, you ask me that every time, and every time I say yes, and then something happens.
I should stop asking you?
I delay it. And no, the answer is absolutely a resounding hell yes, I'm going to be doing more podcasts.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I'm in a position right now, like everyone else, where there's only one of me, and I like doing a lot of things. And so, you know, there's working on the security product, and there's doing some other development, and then there's traveling, and then I'm, you know, trying to spend a little bit of time with my wife because she likes to see me, and somewhere in there is a podcast.
Excellent.
I'll find it.
Well, you know that you guys can always find me over at obviously fxguide.com and also at fxphd.com, and I'm on Twitter at @MikeSeymour. Thanks again so much, guys, for listening. In upcoming shows, we have some really cool stuff coming, including some more of this style of espionage work. Hopefully we're going to be doing some stuff on Salt and other good films, and more of the retro ones that you guys, I know, really, really enjoy. Until then, I'm Mike Seymour. Thanks for listening. See ya.